is Judy Berry from Earth First, and when I'm in Portland, I listen to non-commercial community radio, KBOO Portland. No compromise in defense of the truth.
Hey, get a river. When you get the blues, come on
over to Rhythm Shack with Mike Fisher for high energy roots rock, Americana, jam bands, blues, and more. Every second and fifth Monday from 3 to 5:30 a.m. That's Rhythm Shack here on 90.7 FM, KBOO Portland and KBOO.FM.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Good evening, and welcome to Labor Radio, of the working class, by the working class, for the working class. I'm your host, Stephen Siegel, here with co-host Rachel Haynes. Hey, Rachel.
Hey, Stephen.
We are broadcasting around the world from Portland, Oregon. Both of us are public school teachers. We host every second Monday of the month, where we typically interview educators and talk about what's going on in their schools and in their unions. And joining us today in the Zoom is Ursula Wolf-Roca. Welcome, Ursula.
Hi, it's good to be here.
Yeah, I'm glad you could join us. I know it's been a busy couple of days or more for you. So we always like to start by just getting to know our guests a little bit. So can you tell us about your background and experience in teaching and education?
Sure. So I am a white, U.S. born, middle-aged, cisgender woman who is a public school teacher, or has been a public school teacher for the last 20 years, which puts me, you know, smack dab in the representative demographic of most public school teachers. And I taught for 20 years in Lake Oswego, which is a suburb of Portland, and it is sometimes is the wealthiest city in Oregon, and sometimes it doesn't make the cut, but it's up there. It's a very, as the polite term is, affluent city.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's my story of education.
Yeah. How was it that you ended up there?
I student taught at Reynolds High School, which I loved, which is very different from Lake Oswego, and I desperately wanted to get a job there. And I had a sort of funny story of a big gaffe when the vice principal came to watch me student teach. And I did not get hired at Reynolds, but I did get hired at Lake Oswego. And it was my first job, and it grew into a job I really, really loved. And as much as my politics, you know, didn't align with the community, my heart perfectly aligned with the kids, and as it always does.
Yeah, great. And tell us, what inspired you to become a teacher?
So, you know, I was a kid who had close relationships with their teachers. You know, I loved my teachers. I found them, not all of them, obviously, I had some horrendous ones, but the teachers who loved it, I loved them, and it really didn't matter what the subject was. I mean, I had a biology teacher who I adored, I had a history teacher who I adored, and I think what those teachers taught me is, you know, just the beautiful, seductive nature of knowledge, you know. But when I went to college, and after college, I really wanted to get a PhD. I was like deep into loving scholarship and historical inquiry. And then I sort of looked at myself and was like, self, you're only 23 years old. Like, you're going to write some definitive story of some history thing? Like, it just seemed laughable to me. I was a kid. I felt like a kid. And I felt like we don't need more historians that have no life experience, like that have no life working or sort of living outside the academy. And I don't know why I had that sense, but I did. And so I thought, you know, I'm going to teach for 5 years, which is such a ridiculous, the idea that you would just teach for 5 years in retrospect, but you know, what did I know? And, you know, I started teaching and I realized, whoa, this, you can spend your life doing this and it's meaningful and it's challenging and it's deeply embedded in political struggle and all the things that I sort of wanted and needed and loved. And so I never went and got the PhD and I never will.
Yes. Okay. And you're not teaching now is what I understand. So tell us a little bit about that, in your decision to do that, and what have you been up to? What are you up to now?
Yeah, so the decision was a COVID-based decision. I live with my 83-year-old mom, my immunocompromised husband, and my 12-year-old kid. And my district, like Oswego, the end of last year was not in any way making it clear that we would have the option to stay remote. And in fact was saying that if we wanted to have the option to stay entirely remote, we had to reapply. We had to fill out a separate application with like video of us teaching online. And I found that just despicable on about 5 different levels. And I was in a sort of frantic, you know, situation of feeling like I needed to make some decisions quickly with bad information. And so I said, I'm going to resign. And there were some other things that contributed to that, but that was the precipitating event. And luckily, I had been working half-time at the Zen Education Project, and I knew that I would be able to continue to do that work. And that work, in fact, just grew over this year into a full-time position. And so, happily, I was one very, very lucky in terms of having another role that I could pretty easily and seamlessly step into.
That's great. Would you tell our audience a little bit about what the Zen Education Project is?
Yes. So Zen Education Project is named after Howard Zinn, but a lot of folks have a misconception that it's like rooted in his work, which it's not. It's rooted in the sort of spirit of his history, people's history of the United States, which, you know, lifted up the voices of the people, that is groups that tend to be marginalized in mainstream dominant history textbooks. And it is a project of rethinking schools and teaching for change. So two national education nonprofits that have been involved in social justice education, you know, for decades. And so, you know, our central motto at the Zen Education Project is to teach outside the textbook. And so what we do is we try to provide resources for teachers to do that, and for free. So downloadable lessons is the main thing that the Zen Education Project offers, but we also do PD. And this week we've been joking that we should call ourselves the Zen Organizing Project, because we've also been involved in some organizing recently.
Yeah, well, that brings us to today. Today was a day of action around the country to defend educators and students. Can you take us through what inspired today and talk about some of the attacks going on around the country?
Yeah. You know, it's sort of hard. I first of all, I want to make clear that I am one of a collective of people who work at the Zen Education Project, and the Day of Action was also co-coordinated and co-sponsored by the Black Lives Matter at School. And so it's hard for me to sort of speak to the original genesis, but the Zen Education Project had decided that we wanted to do this pledge, which we started, you know, over a month ago, just to get teachers to pledge to teach the truth. And that was sort of a, just to bring attention to the fact that these bills have been popping up everywhere or many, many places that are seeking to restrict what teachers can teach in their classrooms and in schools. And so we wanted something catchy and pithy and relatively low stakes for teachers to just say, you know, I pledge to teach the truth. And that then, interestingly, we started hearing from some folks who were, one gentleman in particular, and I will completely protect his anonymity, but he's in one of the states where one of these bills has passed. He's not even taught yet. He's going into his first year of teaching, and he made the pledge, and he made his public, his pledge public, and he got all kinds of pushback, and had to have a conversation with the admin of the school that was hiring him. And he reached out to us and said, like, what should I do? And I think that kind of thing of like, wow, this isn't just symbolic. Like, there are going to be real teachers facing real attacks and real pressure to keep their heads down, and what we ultimately believe, pressuring them to lie. And so I think, you know, that context is part of what contributed to wanting to do something.
Can you say a little bit more about the legislation that's being either considered or has passed in some of these states?
Yeah, you know, there was a teacher from Texas who I was talking to a couple days ago who was just banging her head against the wall because she said, you know, some of this legislation sounds so, so good. Like, you read the whole first three pages of the bill and it sounds really good, but it's at the end that it's really bad. She's like, what do we do? And so, you know, I think one of the things to say about this legislation is that it uses a bait and switch tactic. That is, that it purports to be anti-discrimination legislation, that it's somehow mandating that nobody be singled out as inferior or superior.
Okay.
But then, so they all begin that way. And you know, that part, most of us are like, yeah, I don't believe that any one group is fundamentally superior or inferior to any other group. But then further down in the legislation, you get the stuff that's much more dangerous, which is that you know, teachers are not allowed to teach that there's any such thing as systemic oppression. And the Florida statute, which just came out a couple days ago, is even more ridiculous and says that you can't teach history that says anything other than that the United States was a nation founded on the ideals found in the Declaration of Independence. I mean, really, like,
yeah,
fascist stuff.
Wow. Okay. So, why are these attacks going on, and who is behind them, and what are they claiming are the reasons for their concerns?
Wow. Well, first of all, just a disclaimer that I wouldn't say I'm an expert, but what is behind them? I will say that I've written a lot of curriculum on voter suppression, and I see these issues as intimately tied together. That is, that voter suppression uses this idea that there is voter fraud that needs to be addressed, and so we need to enact laws that prevent voter fraud. And what these laws are actually doing is disenfranchising Black people, brown people, poor people, disabled people, old people, young people, right? I mean, all the groups that wouldn't be voting for the right-wing legislators that are passing these laws. And I think these education laws do a similar thing. You know, they use this sort of the language of anti-discrimination to encode, you know, laws that are actually going to maintain the status quo and exacerbate existing inequalities. And I think they're related because I think education is, you know, is a foundational building block of a healthy democracy. And so if people aren't educated, they're not going to be able to fully participate in the democratic process. And so the same people that are passing voter suppression laws are passing these laws, and they see the connection, and we need to see it too.
Yeah, you know, I think I can't remember where, but I read somewhere where somebody was positing that part of the motivation was also around the whole privatization of schools movement, in that if you could sort of demonize or villainize teachers as teaching these crazy concepts, that would encourage families to, you know, more families to want to pull their kids out of the public schools and go where they weren't subjected to this kind of teaching.
Yeah, and I mean, in that sense, it's part of the larger and very long, you know, war on the public sector altogether, right? I mean, it's all of a piece.
Today, there were actions happening all over the country, and even the National Education Association put out an email to members. Can you tell us about some of the actions that took place around the country in terms of just what you're aware of?
I mean, I will say that I had hoped I'd have a little more time to actually dig in to look at some of the social media posts for the actions that happened around the country. You know, last I looked, folks were doing stuff in over 20 states. And many of the states where these bills are real, right? Which maybe we'll talk about why it's different in Texas versus Oregon. But we had multiple actions in Texas, for example. One teacher, you know, who I talked a little bit with was showing up at Emancipation Park and doing a teach-in in Houston. And Emancipation Park, I just am mentioning because Juneteenth is next week, and this is one of the sites that memorializes Juneteenth. And I know up north from us, Jesse Hagopian was involved in organizing a march from Garfield High School, which is the historically Black high school, to the Black Panthers, the site of the former Black Panthers office in Seattle. We had folks, you know, doing one person and their kid at a you know, historic marker. We had events in New Hampshire, sort of, and they were small and large. And our point was really just to make sure that folks know we're out here, and that even though for many folks it's already summer or it's almost summer, like, this is really matters. And these laws do not get to be snuck in when teachers are exhausted after the hardest year of teaching in their entire careers. So I sort of lost the question there. So maybe,
oh, it's okay.
Maybe help me out.
You were just, I was just curious about what you knew about what's been going on around the country.
Oh,
you did hint at the difference between, say, a Texas and an Oregon. Do you want to say anything more about that?
Yeah, I mean, I just want to emphasize that I really, and I know you both know this, but I really think the threat is universal, and that it would be a real mistake for those of us in states without legislation to act as though this isn't a threat to us as well. And I know that there are some real tangible teachers in Oregon who have been impacted and who have been hurt by right-wing attacks.
Yes, we interviewed our guest last month, actually.
Oh, great. Wow. Yeah, so, and so I guess I want us to see this as an opportunity to think about solidarity, and which I don't think any, you know, Americans get, for the most part, get much training or education on how to, and I really suffer from that too, I think, all the time. Like, I want to act in solidarity and I have no idea how, you know? And so I think our events today were, you know, scrappy, but they also were an opportunity to build those muscles and practice those muscles of what it will mean to really stand up for teachers elsewhere. Who, like that teacher I mentioned earlier, who are going to be suffering real consequences for teaching U.S. history, which is, you know, absolutely ludicrous.
Yeah, I mean, just to bring it back to even here where we aren't seeing the legislation, we are seeing individual teachers have Freedom of Information Acts about, you know, mining their Google Drive for lessons and curriculum they've developed, their emails, so very targeted. And most often it's teachers of color, educators mm-hmm. of color that are getting this targeted response from right wing, and Fox News is picking up on it, and you
right.
know, it becomes right. like a real dangerous situation
right.
for them. Well, could you tell us about the actions that took place here in Portland today?
Yeah, well, I only attended one of them, so you all might need to help me out a little bit. But we had four actions here in Portland that I know about. There may have been some other individual actions. We had a rally at the waterfront in the morning that included speakers and a tour, and it was sort of centered around the memorial, Japanese American memorial that's on the waterfront, and tells the story not just of Japanese incarceration, but including Japanese incarceration. And I note that because these bills, right, focus on systemic oppression and are in a bit would make it difficult for us to teach that. And so that's a story that would become hard to teach well in the context of teaching under one of these bills. And that one, I think, you know, it sounded like there were, you know, 50 or 60 people who came out, and great speakers and poems, and it sounded like a great event. And then we partnered with Vanport Mosaic to do a community organization here committed to teaching the history of Vanport. They donated 10 tickets to teachers who wanted to tour their exhibit that's happening right now at Vanport, I mean at Pittock Mansion, and to learn a bit more about that history. And then I participated in an event at around Block 14 at Lone Fir Cemetery, which is a mass burial site of Chinese workers and folks from a mental hospital in Oregon from about 100 years ago, that some activists have been trying to get a marker and a memorial garden placed there. And then finally, we had an action at the Oregon Holocaust Memorial with about 20 educators who showed up, talked about how Holocaust history would have to be taught differently were these laws in effect. And so all four events folks showed up for. And again, I'm just noting that it's the end of the school year for most teachers, so the fact that we had folks show up, I think, is a real testament to how super important this issue is, and also how you know, how engaged Portland educators are.
Yeah, and it was such a great opportunity for people to learn about things in our own city, like the loan for Block 14. I didn't know anything about that until
me neither.
Fall, and I was like, oh, I should research this. And yeah, so it's like a great opportunity for us to be teaching each other and
bring right.
things for our classroom.
Right.
So do you have any thoughts or plans for what might be next for educators in this fight against right-wing attacks on teaching the truth?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to be too snarky, but my first thing is that the big unions just have to step up. That, I mean, this event should not have been planned by two little scrappy nonprofits, right? Like, this should have been planned by the two largest teachers unions in the country. So that's thing one. Thing two is that we would really like, I and my fellow organizers, I know that we would really like to find ways to reach out to local organizers in the places where these attacks are most felt, the places where laws have actually passed, and really figure out what they need from those of us who are in places like Oregon. And because I think what I've been hearing in talking to teachers in these different places is they really need sort of different things, like You know, I don't know that the teachers in Texas and the teachers in Iowa and the teachers in Cobb County, Georgia, you know, need the same thing. And we are not in a position to go in and tell anybody what they need. So we need to find some way of communicating what local organizers' needs are, and then finding a way to organize around offering whatever support we can offer. And I know that sounds sort of vague, but that is what we've been talking about. How do we do that? One of the things that we heard in organizing this event from folks around the country was how hungry people were, and this is sort of sad, but how hungry people were for media training. I mean, people were just very scared about being asked questions by the press and not knowing how to answer. And you know, the age old discussion of like, is teaching political? Like, well, there you go, right? If you feel like you need press training in order to talk about your job, you know, I think that tells you something. So that kind of thing, like if folks on the ground in Texas say like, we really need some media training on how to answer these questions about CRT, is that something that the rest of us could kind of crowdsource and provide?
Yeah, there's talk in Portland of, you know, coming up with kind of a template response for when teachers get targeted, to be able to give, you know, all the way from the district leadership to union leadership to people in the building, you know, like what are the acts of solidarity and support that need to just automatically happen instead of, you know, this like delayed response to try to.
Or just a completely devastating response, as was the case when I read the articles about Beaverton. It sounded like the initial district response was not just bad, but really devastatingly bad. So yeah, that would be super useful.
We were able to pass at our last. You talked about that at the. Seeing more action coming from the big unions, right? Coming from AFT and NEA. And I can say that at our state level that we did pass a new business item that is going to require some work done on having protocols in place for when an attack happens. So there isn't this sort of flat-footed response, you know, kind of caught off guard, like what do we do? And then all we have is maybe some legal advice, but yeah. So I think that's certainly a step in the right direction.
Right. And you know, I mean, I have to say that as I'm listening to you and I'm thinking, good. Another part of my brain is going, who is ever going to want to teach if this is what? I mean, I think about how hard. When I first taught, was a brand new teacher, and I taught in Lake Oswego. And so when I would teach Palestine, I would always get, you know, lots of parent pushback on the way that I taught Palestine. And I mean, I would lose sleep at night. It would take over my life to deal with this kind of pushback I would get. And it was pretty minor compared to what some of these teachers are facing. And so, you know, I mean, this has absolutely got to be a priority for unions. So I'm glad to hear that is happening here in Oregon.
And what a perfect place to end this interview. Thank you so much for coming and joining us on KBOO and being willing to talk about this, Ursula. Thank you to Jamie Partridge for helping us convert this to a radio-ready file. Thank you, audience, for tuning in tonight. Thank you, Stephen. This is Rachel Haynes. You've been listening to Labor Radio. Tune in next Monday and every Monday at 6 to catch another Labor Radio show.
You're tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
Produced at the studios of KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon, this is Prison Pipeline. I'm Doug McVeigh. Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration. We seek to promote awareness and activism in order to foster a safe, healthy, and just society. Efforts are ongoing in states across the nation to reform the criminal legal system. In the state of New York, community organizers and social justice activists have just scored a major victory in that state's legislature. On Thursday, June 10th, the New York State Senate and New York State Assembly passed S. 1144, entitled Relates to Revocation of Community Supervision. A modest title,